Celebrating diversity, this is Bristol's BCFM 93.2.
Good morning, wake up, Devin Shaw on the radio. Just wonderful to be with you. And just checking out some of the celebrity gossip and some of your letters for Wendy's Mail. Good morning and hello, WC on the radio. And I've just got to check through some of the celebrity stories and the gossip. We see here that... Well, I was reading a review of a brand new film about the life of Jerry Lee Lewis. And it's called Great Balls of Fire. And I said the guy said that he wasn't too hot on the film. He said that they left out the bit about him. What's that? Sorry, my producer's interrupting here. What? Pedophile. Okay, well, apparently, yeah, he had a great big collection of information about feet.
Disgrace, and it is a public scandal.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Was it really only February the 1st this year, the time of Trump's 2019 State of the Union address, that the US pulled out of the INF Treaty? Well, that's intermediate nuclear forces to you and I. There's a six-month period of grace which is about to expire, with neither side admitting fault. So tonight we ask, just who really violated the treaty, bringing us closer to a nuclear war in Europe between NATO and Russia? And what does a tactical nuclear arms race look like for us mere mortals who are forced to pay for it? Plus the good old Straits of Hormuz in the Persian Gulf. What's the US Navy doing there so far from home? And are the BBC reporting what's going on accurately? Plus a leading US Jew on the Labour anti-Semitism scandal and the very real historical ties between the Zionist Israel lobby and the Nazis. He argues the row between rival Jewish factions in the Labour Party mirrors similar inter-Jewish disagreements in 1930s America in the run-up to World War II. Plus, Catherine Austin Fitz on the future of money and why we should all be concerned when we're being herded. Using the word herded because we all need the stuff, money that is, but nobody's being asked about the huge changes to the way we manage and spend it. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM on Tuesday at noon this week, the first of a two-part series on the Glastonbury Abbey sphere of influence. We travel to Shapwick House, the site of the arrest of Abbot Whiting in September 1539. He was subsequently executed on the tour right at the very end of the dissolution of the monasteries. And Mark Hutchinson and Luke Loder from the Abbey's Education Office look at the role of this massive medieval institution's almoner, whose job, a bit like the job centres today, was to distribute a good deal of the wealth of the Abbey to the poor. You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday, or download it right now from dialectradio.co.uk. But we start right now, Martin, by picking up somewhere where we left off right at the end of the first hour there, which is looking at this old man at the zoo. The idea of a Middle East war has been reflected in our culture in the 1960s and 1970s quite a lot, actually, hasn't it? I seem to remember films talking about when are the Americans going to invade the Middle East, even back in the 1970s. It's not as if this is all new, having a big, powerful US presence in the Middle East, is it?
Well, no, I mean, it's the most likely region for a world war to start. And
Why?
Because it's where the tectonic plates of geopolitics rub up against each other. There's other places that are.
I mean, what you're saying there is it's Africa, Europe, and Asia, and it's where all three meet and cross over.
Well, it's more to do with where the limits of U.S. power rub up against the Iranians, the Russians, etc., and the State of Israel, of course, is a continuous provocation and engages in provocation in the region. They carry on bombing Syria, even though the Syrians have not retaliated in any way, to the, apart from shooting down things that are being fired at them. And the potential, the Straits of Hormuz, for some accidental miscalculation leading to a conflagration is very, very real.
What's the US Navy doing in the Straits of Hormuz? It doesn't really need to be there, or does
well,
it?
Well, I mean, the US has always taken the position that they've got a right to intervene in the Persian Gulf because it's so important for the world economy that the oil flows from the Persian Gulf, and therefore they feel that they've got their right, the right to stick their finger in, and as we know, they're talking about putting ships there to protect against Iranian interdiction. But of course, the Persian Gulf is called the Persian Gulf for a reason. It's because it's Iran's English Channel, if you like, and it's all their territorial waters.
I suppose the comparison, I made it last week, didn't I? The idea that you might get, Iranian gunboats or battleships sort of going up and down the Thames or the Bristol Channel. That's what we're looking at here.
Well, that's right. The Iranians are saying, look, you know, this is our part of the world, you know. We haven't got Iranian battleships off New York Harbour, have we? You're the ones who say. Of course, the thing is, of course, that it's a death trap. If it comes to a fight, every NATO vessel inside the Persian Gulf will be sunk almost immediately. And therefore, what they need to do is have them out in the Indian Ocean so they can have they can attack from long distance. And if they're actually inside the Gulf when the balloon goes up, all those people are as good as dead straight away.
Anyway, Angus Wilson's book from 1961, Old Men at the Zoo, it was translated in it's a BBC a million miles away from today's BBC drama, in 1983, a series called The Old Men at the Zoo, which had been updated by Troy Kennedy Martin with the backing of Angus Wilson, with some of the new things brought in to do with nuclear war in the Middle East and that sort of thing. But anyway, what this does, this drama, Martin, and you know, maybe you can comment on why we don't see this sort of thing happening nowadays, and I'll put some links up to the versions of it online. The BBC don't sell it for some reason as a DVD, because it blends together this idea of fascist takeover in Britain at the same time as a Middle Eastern war breaking out.
Well, I mean, this is obviously a work of fiction, but nevertheless, the kind of topics that it's covering are very much to the point in the world that we live in, aren't they?
What Angus teases out in this drama is the secret obsession of the natural history bigwigs and zoo owners with eugenics, and the idea that an admiration for physical strength over intellectual strength, which he found absolutely abhorrent, and he found it rife, or he believed it was rife within the sort of natural history profession.
Well, look, I don't know the particular piece of work that you're referring to, so I can't really comment.
All right, well, what I'll do is I'll just simply put a link up on our show page, and I think, you know, it's fascinating that the fascist takeover in Britain as a Middle Eastern war threatens Europe. It's all kind of got some of these interesting parallels for today. The animals moved out of London to a safe location, and punks and other young protesters, like the Extinction Rebellion people, I imagine, locked up in a London zoo, almost like in a menagerie. So let's have a listen. Little listen now to an extract from that.
You're never going to have a war. We're all likely to get blown up.
Is it that bad?
The Arabs won't back down, and the Europeans, well, you know what the French are like. The chances of them blowing each other to smithereens are very high, and of course, once they're in, we are. How do you feel about that?
Well, I don't like the idea of my wife and two children dying in a nuclear firestorm. No.
Sugar?
No.
But it's on the cards, you know, sometime in the autumn.
Lord God Manchester, I am not one of your employees. I am a public servant employed by the Royal Zoological Society.
Rubbish. I run the zoo with the aid of the monarch. I'm going to take you into my confidence. As you're no doubt aware, for some time I've been mounting a campaign to get myself back into office. However, the situation is so grave that the country may have to forego the luxury of an election and accept a coalition government. The situation is so bad, it needs someone like me to get them out of trouble. I'm telling you all this because I'm going to be very busy from now on, and I'm going to leave the affairs of the zoo in your hands. Yes?
We've got Wallbanger on Channel 4.
Oh. Excuse me.
First, the Arabs do not have the capability to deliver a nuclear bomb, even if they had one. And secondly, I think once we step out of the conflict, you guys are more likely to come to terms. Thank you.
General Warbanger has now left for an undisclosed destination.
He's wrong on both counts. The Arabs have the bomb, are not able to deliver it. I don't think we should reach a settlement without American help.
Well, that's an extract from the 1983 BBC drama, The Old Men at the Zoo there. But Martin, there is this aspect to it all, which is, there was actually, you know, one of the influences on that drama, and let's point out this is not fact, this is just drama from 1983, a very different BBC now, was that this sort of thing could actually happen, a Middle Eastern war.
Well, we've had, that was in 1983, and we've had several wars in the Middle East since then.
And also the coup
including
aspect.
Including the Iran-Iraq war, the invasion of Iraq.
But this is in the
Kuwait,
wake.
The invasion
Martin,
of Iraq.
Martin, this is the wake of the 70s. There actually was a coup attempt in Britain.
Yes, there was, because the Labour government at the time had fallen foul of the pro-American deep state here, and Wilson, there's a BBC Two drama documentary about it, with James Boland playing Wilson, and it's all based on Penrose and Courtier, the British BBC journalists that were brought into Wilson's confidence about the coup attempt,
and then booted
him
out of the BBC. Yeah. Yes, for their trouble. The book is, by the way,
the possibility of a pro-NATO coup in this country is definitely there.
The book is called The Pencourt Files, mm-hmm. Or Pencourt File. Fascinating read. I read about, I don't know, 20 years ago or something, and you couldn't. I mean, as you say,
there's a British Army general who's on the record as saying that if Corbyn comes to power, the army will remove him. They've said that.
Is he retired or serving?
No, he was a serving officer, but they refused to identify him. But if he could be identified, he should, of course, be sacked.
That could just be the Times hearsay, couldn't it?
Well, he went on the record in the Times without giving his name and said that Corbyn wouldn't be allowed to be Prime Minister, the army would never stand for it. Now, in actual fact, that's treason, and he should probably be prosecuted, never mind lose his job. But, of course, we're too wishy-washy, really. We ought to take the gloves off and give those people a bloody nose.
So, getting back to this sort of conflict with the Arabs and the possibility of Iran having a nuclear weapon at some point, the almost unspoken truth.
The Iranians aren't Arabs, but yes.
Unspoken nuclear weapons of Israel, which are, you know, not even officially declared. What do you make of that?
Well, they're not officially declared because under the Logan Act, which is a US congressional act, any country that proliferates nuclear weapons has to be put under complete sanctions, and that's why the Israelis won't admit they've got nuclear weapons, because that would bring the Logan Act would kick in, and the US would be forced to put sanctions.
So what do you make this week of these claims by the Americans that they've shot down an Iranian drone, but then the Iranians saying, well, we have definitely not lost a drone today?
Well, I think what that's about is Trump lost face when the Iranians shot down his drone, and therefore he's pretending that he shot down one of
theirs.
This
is schoolboy stuff.
Well, it is, yes, but it's also
actually less. It's nursery type stuff.
It's nursery type stuff with 21st century weapons, which could end up in lots of people being incinerated.
What's the facts of the matter? What do you think?
I think they're making it up. I think the Iranians basically, I don't think the Iranian drone was shot down. I think the Americans are making it up, but I've got no proof of that. I just don't believe a word they say about anything.
Let's have a listen now to an analysis by the BBC's Frank Gardner on the Iran tensions and the supposed shoot down of this Iranian drone this week.
We are in a kind of weird twilight zone at the moment where there isn't open conflict between Iran and the US, but there are these incidents which slowly ratchet up tension, matched by a slow incremental increase in the US stationing planes and forces in the Gulf. We're not talking here about any kind of build-up to an invasion of Iran. No one is talking about that. This isn't Iraq in 2003. At the same time, in parallel, you've got diplomats, including Gulf diplomats, who are trying to find a way around this, some kind of a escape route for the, you know, an escape valve for the steam that is building up here. And yes, the talk of increased inspections is one aspect of that. That would run contrary, though, to what the hawks in Washington, specifically John Bolton and Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, are trying to do. They want to really put so much pressure on Iran, particularly on its economy, that it comes begging back for a new deal, which includes reducing their missile capability and curtailing the activities of their militias around the region. The hardliners in Iran aren't going to go for that.
Well, that's pretty obvious stuff. They want a war with Iran. The Israelis have been banging on about it for ages and ages and ages. But if they're going to have a war, they've got to move all the military into position.
What's
to have
in it for the United States? I can see the advantage to Israel, but not for the US.
The United States wants to be full spectrum dominance. They don't want any countries outside their control, and that includes. And Iran's a very important country, and it's aligned with the US's supposed enemies, China and Russia, and they want to, they basically want to they want regime change in all three countries. They're not going to get it because they're not strong enough. But by pushing for it, they may precipitate a world war, which will kill a lot of people, including people in this room.
When the U.S. Congresswoman Ilhan Omar calls Trump a fascist, is she correct in that? I mean, this whole idea of having world domination.
Well, I mean, the word fascist gets bandied around.
This whole idea of world domination is for the birds, surely.
Well, it's not, because the U.S. Dominates the international financial system. Basically, countries have to pay tribute to the US through the international, the international debt and so on. Wall Street dominates the planet. But of course, it hasn't got complete domination, because the Russians are militarily outside of their control, and the Chinese are economically outside of their control. And of course, they're working together to create a new multipolar world order, in which Central Asia will become predominant.
Surely this quest for world domination is doomed to fail. It can't.
Well, yes, you would think
the closer they get to it, the less likely it is to happen, because the other big power blocks are going to get together and stop it.
What we should be doing is everybody should be talking to everybody else about solving our mutual problems on this speck of dust floating around in the middle of nowhere. We were talking about the space race earlier. Really, there's no reason why Russian, Chinese, American and Europeans couldn't get together and create a more balanced setup with a win-win for everybody.
Anyway.
But of course, the dominant powers, the dominant forces, oligarchy in the West, won't accept that.
Anyway, this week, BBC's Hard Talk did an excellent interview, I thought. Anyway, it's good to see, with Javid Zarif. He's the Iranian foreign minister, and here he talks about what's happening with the Iran nuclear deal, otherwise known as the JCPOA, and nuclear weapons over in Iran, and potential of them.
This deal was written based on total mistrust. Neither side trusted the other side. That is why we put everything in black and white. Very clearly stated that if we don't comply, what they can take, if we are the initial breakers of the deal, they can take measures. If they are the initial breakers of the deal, they can also take measures.
You've got to allay fears, haven't you, Foreign Minister? The Iranians, according to the British Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt, he has said this week that Iran is a year away from developing a nuclear bomb.
If Iran wanted to build a bomb, we would have built a bomb a long time ago. We could have built a bomb a long time ago. We do not want to build a bomb because we believe that a nuclear bomb will not augment our security. But if the Europeans are serious about a nuclear weapons-free Middle East, there is somewhere else that they need to be looking, and that's Israel, where they have at least 200 nuclear warheads.
President Trump said quite recently that he was 10 minutes away from war with Iran over the shooting down of the unmanned U.S. drone over what America says was international waters, and the French President Emmanuel Macron agrees with that. You say no, it was over Iranian waters and so on. But do you accept that the U.S. doesn't want war?
I accept that President Trump doesn't want war, but I know that there are people in his administration who are crazy for war, who thirst for war.
John Bolton, the National Security Advisor, who...
I don't think I need to mention him. President Trump himself has mentioned him.
How do you assess the possibility, the likelihood of some kind of military engagement between Iran and America?
You see, it's called Persian Gulf for a reason. It's next to our coast. We have almost 1,500 miles of coast with Persian Gulf. It's not the Gulf of Mexico. We're there, we're protecting our territorial waters. And if this drone had been shot in international waters, over international airspace, why did we got to pick up the pieces?
Well, I mean, we don't often get to hear the Iranian point of view, do we? And when we do hear it, it just sounds like common sense. Meanwhile, we're just subjected to lots of bluster. And of course, Britain is now being dragged into a confrontation with the Iranians because of the seizure of this tanker in the Mediterranean. And that's basically just, we are being used as America's bitch here, basically.
Hard Talk also talked to Zainab Badawi, talking to Javed Zarif about economic warfare.
President Trump has said that I am not engaged in military war against Iran, I'm engaged in economic war against Iran. What does it mean to be engaged in economic war? Economic war targets civilians. Military war targets military personnel. Civilians are sometimes collateral damage. But an economic war targets civilians. The United States Secretary Pompeo has said that we want the Iranian people to change their government. So, putting these two together, that means that the United States is terrorizing Iranian people in order to achieve political objectives. That's the classical definition of terrorism.
The Americans have said consistently, Mike Pompeo, is their goal is not regime change. He says, we want to change Iran's behavior so it behaves like
a normal country. Mike Pompeo,
that's what he has said.
Iran is a normal country. The country that is not normal is the United States.
Right.
Which normal country violates every international agreement? INF,
right.
NAFTA, the Paris Climate Convention,
right.
UNESCO, Human Rights Council. Is that what you call normal?
Let me put to you, though, you've said your country's suffering from the sanctions. When you give organisations like Hezbollah hundreds of millions of dollars a year,
Who said we give them hundreds of millions? Well, that's what Mike Pompeo said. Mike Pompeo,
keep the money for your people.
Mike Pompeo may like to make statements.
Right.
You see, Mike Pompeo's allies in our region, Saudi Arabia, spend $67 billion a year on military equipment. They are bombing the Yemenis. Are we doing that? We only spent $16 billion last year on military, entire military budget.
Well, the Iranians are quite right there. I mean, they have a military budget because they're being threatened. And they're being threatened by the Israelis with nuclear weapons. They're being threatened by the Americans. They're being threatened by the British. Therefore, they have to spend some money on defence, including supplying stuff to their allies, just as we spend loads of money helping the Saudis to kill Yemeni children, because it's in our national interest, apparently.
Well, he mentioned, that is, you just heard there, the Iranian Foreign Minister, Javed Zarif, mentioned the INF Treaty. Now, Martin, this is actually quite important, isn't it? This is the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, which Trump pulled out of back in February, because he's saying that the Russians have violated it. Well, the Russians also pulled out, literally the day after Trump pulled out of it, saying, well, if you're going to pull out, there's no point in us just having this treaty on our own. And we're just about to run out of the 6 months period of grace where either can rejoin it. Well, I mean, why are these intermediate nuclear forces important?
Well, if you remember back in the 1980s when Cruz and Pershing were being deployed in Western Europe, as it then was, and in Britain at Greenham Common and so on, these were dangerous for two reasons. The Pershing missile, which is based in Germany, could hit Moscow very, very quickly, and therefore the other side had to be on a complete hair trigger. In 1983, when that program that you were talking about earlier, the Zoo program, we nearly had a nuclear war by accident in 1983. The Soviets were genuinely concerned that there was going to be a surprise attack on them, and don't forget that NATO's strategic doctrine has always been that we won't say we won't use them first. Both the Russians and the Chinese have always said we will never use nuclear weapons first, but NATO won't say that. And of course, the Americans have directly threatened to use nuclear weapons against non-nuclear states like North Vietnam and other.
Haven't the Israelis too?
Well, the Israelis basically, Sheldon Adelson, who's the biggest funder of the U.S. Republican Party, said that we should turn Iran into a field of glass. That's what he said. That's what he wants.
Well, on this Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, the BBC's Jonathan Marcus was interviewed about that and on the World Service, and he was asked, is the treaty dead?
Well, sadly, I think it is dead. It was a very important agreement during the Cold War years because it removed a whole category of weapons, what were then called intermediate-range nuclear forces. These were weapons essentially with which the Soviet Union threatened Western Europe and which, from Western Europe, weapons that threatened the Soviet Union. They were simply abolished altogether. The genesis of this row is that the Russians have been developing systems for a long time, which the NATO side and the West believe broke the treaty. The Russians deny that, but the evidence, as far as we can see, is fairly considerable. And to that extent, the Americans said, well, if the Russians aren't going to come back into compliance, then we're not going to honour the treaty either. That deadline for the American formal withdrawal comes in just a short time.
Well, the reasons why the US have withdrawn from this treaty is because they want to threaten China with short-range nuclear weapons, base played probably in Taiwan and Japan. And the INF treaty is only covers, you know, they want basically to be able to use weaponry. If you think of it from the Russian point of view, the NATO forces are much, much closer to them than their forces are to the hegemon, the Americans. So the danger for the Russians is that a surprise attack, and don't forget they've got missiles in Romania and in Poland, which could be used for a surprise attack on Russia. And of course, what happened in the 80s was, because they thought that there was going to be a surprise attack, they got everything on a hair trigger. Whereas if you actually have a situation where both sides are saying we'd never use them first, then everybody can relax a bit because it's clear that there isn't going to be a first strike from either side. But if the US is basically saying we want to keep the option of a first strike on the table, then inevitably the Russians are going to make their
The Russians
response.
Are making a big fuss about the missile defence system, but surely that is, although it's in several places in Eastern Europe and there are more going in of these so-called missile defence systems, the Russians are saying that can be used offensively too.
Of course it can. Of course it can. And of course, if the Russians were to put similar missiles, say, into Cuba or Venezuela, you could see what the Americans would do. They'd go absolutely bonkers. And the Russians are saying, well, if you'd go absolutely bonkers if we did that, why should we put up for it when you do that to us? Their strategic doctrine is very clear. If you use nuclear weapons against us, we are going to go all out and we're going to wipe you out. And they've actually developed a whole new long-range missile structure, which means that within half an hour they can hit anywhere on the planet, right into the central Midwestern United
now, this,
States.
Now, this conflict is all over this Russian... NATO calls it the SSC-8. The Russians call it the Noviator 9M729. Now, the Russians say that it doesn't have the range that the Americans say it has. They say that the range is just less than, or just more, that I'm not sure, actually.
Yeah, well,
anyway,
I
mean, there's a disagreement about the capabilities of this weapon.
Well, I mean, the problem is the geography of the situation is not the same. The Russians can threaten Western Europe with a short-range missile, but they certainly can't hit the US unless they put them in somewhere like Cuba. Yeah? Which is what they tried in the 1960s, and it nearly led to a nuclear war. But of course, the Americans have deployed similar missiles in Turkey, and the deal at the end of the Cuban Missile Crisis is we will take our missiles out of Cuba, and you get those missiles in Turkey out of our face. Now, ultimately, if there's goodwill on both sides, you don't want short-range missiles pointed at everybody in everybody's face. You just have long-range missiles, which will probably never be used because it just means nuclear holocaust, mutually assured destruction. The problem with the Western strategic doctrine is that they still think in terms of fighting and winning a nuclear war. The Russians aren't interested in that. So if it's a nuclear war, we're just going to kill you all. That's it.
Jonathan Marcus also responded when he was asked, what do you think NATO will do in response?
Well, I think the first thing it isn't going to do is deploy more missiles of its own. I think that would be very unpopular in terms of public opinion. I think public opinion has in many ways moved on since the 1970s and 80s. I think you will see robust steps. You might see more anti-missile defences being deployed, for example, and so on. But I don't think we're going to get into a kind of missile arms race for shorter and medium range systems deployed on the ground in Europe.
Well, I think that's right, because the Russians aren't going to take the bait. They've got long-range missiles which can wipe out, for example, the US 6th Fleet in the Mediterranean in an afternoon. They can wipe out cities if they want to in the central United States. They're not going to piddle around with lots of short-range weaponry. That's NATO's game. NATO wants to spend money on lots of expensive kit anyway, because it's a boondoggle. The Russian defense industry is virtually entirely nationalized. Every penny they spend on missiles is penny they can't spend on butter. So they think very carefully about what they actually need, and they're not just developing stuff for the hell of it, which, of course, was what happens in the West.
There's no point in talking to the monkey. Let's talk to the organ grinder, that is to say, Jens Stoltenberg. And he spoke to the BBC yesterday. He's the Secretary General of NATO on this treaty.
These new Russian missiles, which they now have deployed over some years, are nuclear capable. They can reach European cities within a few minutes, so they're reducing the warning time and therefore also the threshold for any potential use of nuclear weapons in an armed conflict. And they are very hard to detect. They are mobile. So this is serious. We still call on Russia to come back into compliance, and Russia still has the opportunity to save the treaty by destroying the missiles they have deployed, which are in clear violation of the treaty. At the same time, we see that the time is running out. There's an absolute deadline, the 2nd of August, and we have seen no signs whatsoever that Russia is going to come back into compliance with the treaty. So therefore, we have to be prepared for a world without the INF treaty and with more Russian missiles.
So, Martin, the all this work that was done during the Cold War by Reagan, Brezhnev, Gorbachev, the rest of them, it seems to be being torn up right now.
Well, it's if the Americans were genuinely seeking world peace and presenting a kind of pacifistic view to, outlook to the world, we might take some of us what they say seriously. But I'm afraid their credibility has gone. They lied about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. They've lied about an awful lot of stuff. Their intelligence services are terrorists. They've been working with Al-Qaeda for years and years and years, as the Russians are well aware. And ultimately, you can't believe a word they say. And Jens Stoltenberg, the Norwegian, he's basically a low-level person. He just gets told what to say by the Americans and the British. And then he just comes out with it.
Just to clear things up, this disputed Russian missile, the 9M729, the Russians call it, or the SSC-8, they say that it has a range capability in excess of 1,000 kilometres, but not in excess of 5,000 kilometres. So this is about... what does this actually mean on the battlefield? Because some people are saying that it all makes having these sorts of missiles around makes a nuclear war more likely.
Well, the shorter range stuff and the smaller stuff is probably the most dangerous, because foolish people might think they could use them. The long range stuff is really, you know, it's all or nothing when you use that stuff. But of course, the problem is there's a basic asymmetry in the geography. The Russians can hit Western Europe with something like that, but they can't hit the United States. Whereas, of course, NATO is right up on the Russian border now, and they can, you know, they can lob a nuclear missile over in a matter of minutes, straight into the heart of the Russian.
Anyway, I thought maybe
heartland.
We should just get a little bit more of Jens Stoltenberg, since he's the guy who seems to be in charge in NATO, to go a little bit more
only on paper
in depth. What do you mean by that?
The head of NATO has to be a European by convention, but Stoltenberg basically he doesn't decide anything. It's decided the generals in the Pentagon decide what's going to happen, and Stoltenberg just gets to read the script.
Okay, well,
I don't think he's got any power at all.
Let's have a listen to him doing precisely that in Toronto earlier this week. Now,
Russia has deployed for several years now the new intermediate range missile, which is in clear violation of the INF treaty, and therefore all NATO allies agreed when the United States announced in the beginning of February that they will start a withdrawal process from the treaty unless Russia comes back into compliance. So far, Russia has shown no sign of coming back into compliance, and the deadline ends on the 2nd of August, as in 2 weeks from now. But since there is still some time, we are still calling on Russia to come back into compliance,
because we strongly believe that the INF Treaty have served us all well as a intermediate range as a nuclear forces. The treaty ban as a, the INF Treaty is, has been and still is a cornerstone for arms control. Because it didn't only reduce the number of intermediate range weapons, it banned them all. And that's the reason why it is so extremely serious that Russia is now violating this treaty, and the demise of the treaty will be extremely serious for all of us. As you know, the challenge with the intermediate range weapons is that the new Russian missile is that they are mobile, hard to detect, nuclear capable, can reach European cities within minutes, and by doing so they also reduce the threshold for any potential use of nuclear weapons in an armed conflict. And that's the reason why we take this extremely serious, the fact that Russia has now deployed these weapons for some time. If Russia doesn't come back into compliance, we will respond. I will not be specific today exactly on how we will respond, but we made some decisions at the defense ministerial meeting in June in NATO. What we will do will be measured, it will be coordinated, and we have said that we will not mirror what Russia is doing. We don't have any intentions of deploying land-based nuclear missiles in Europe. But of course we have other options. We have conventional, we have readiness of forces, we have exercises, we have missile defense. There are other options for NATO, and we will do what is necessary to make sure that in a world without the INF Treaty and with a more Russian nuclear-capable intermediate-range missiles, we will make sure that NATO continues to provide credible and effective deterrence. So we will respond, but we will respond in a measured and balanced way.
The NATO powers have deployed short-range missiles in Poland and Romania, pointed directly at Moscow. When they put them in, they said, we're doing this to prevent the Iranians from attacking anybody. So the Putin was told at the time, we're putting these in, they're not directed at you, they're directed at the Iranians. And basically, the Russians just laughed, because these missiles are pointed directly at Moscow, they're short-range missiles, they're already there, and if the Russians were taking steps to put their own missiles on a hair trigger, pointing back towards them. There's an obvious solution here. The NATO should just withdraw its missiles from Romania and Poland, which is what the Russians have been asking for years, but they won't do it.
And they're going to also install them in the Baltic states too.
Well, I mean, indeed, but of course the Russian response could be that we're going to put our short-range missiles in Cuba, because if you can put your missiles in our face, we can put our missiles in your face.
I'm not sure what the Cubans would have to say to that, but
the Venezuelans would probably say
in the New York Times this month, just a couple of weeks ago, NATO is considering missile defence upgrade, risking further tensions with Russia.
Well, the real problem here is the desire to try and make the Russians do what we want instead of to talking to them like adults about how we could share the world together. And that's because there's a military-industrial complex in the West in which a lot of ex-generals and all the rest of it they retire and they go on the boards of these companies and it pays their pensions and puts their kids in private
you're
schools.
Absolutely right. Public you're absolutely right about the Iranian angle, because the Russians are saying, well, why do you need this system? Now the Iranians have agreed in 2015 to stop any nuclear enrichment program and threatening to direct missiles at the alliance's interceptor sites.
Well, in other words, it's just bad faith, isn't it? Everybody can see that these missiles in Romania and Poland are not directed at the Iranians, they're directed at the Russians. But NATO pretends that it's nothing to do with the Russians, it's all to do with the Iranians, even though they haven't got a nuclear weapon. And so, the fact is that NATO, just lies. And of course, there's an easy thing that they could do. They could say, we won't use nuclear weapons first, which is what the Russians have always said. But NATO won't do that. And don't forget that the US has threatened, has used nuclear weapons on Japan and has threatened to use them on other non-nuclear states several times since World War II. They threatened to use them in Korea. They threatened the North Vietnamese with them. The North Vietnamese said, go on, we dare you.
But ultimately, Martin, this is just all saber-rattling right now. There are, the idea is that by threatening these sorts of things, you can get people to do what you want because they'll be simply afraid of you. You don't have any intention of actually using them.
Well, you can say, but you could miscalculate that, couldn't you? Completely. And that's what may happen. A nuclear war will probably happen, if it happens, and God forbid that it should, by accident. It nearly happened in 1983. The colonel who was in charge on the Russian side was about to press the button, and then he had a word with himself and he didn't press it, and it turned out to be a flock of swans rather than missiles. So it's just as well that he hesitated, because if he hadn't hesitated, we wouldn't be here now having this conversation.
This is your award-winning BCFM. BCFM on 93.2, 24 hours a day.
If you're an EU citizen living in the UK, you will need to apply to the EU Settlement Scheme. The scheme is fully open and you have plenty of time to apply. It is free and all you need is your passport or ID card and to complete an online form. Support is available if you have any questions. To find out more and to apply, visit gov.uk/EU Settlement Scheme. Irish citizens or those with valid indefinite leave don't need to apply.
Now, Martin, on to a bit about the Labour anti-Semitism scandal. This is rolling on and on and on. I mean, it almost seems like every evening on Channel 4 News, there's another blow. Somebody within the Labour Party has resigned or called for Jeremy Corbyn to do something about this. And now it's all moved to the idea of outsourcing the Labour Party's own disciplinary procedures to an outside body from the Labour Party, because people don't trust the leadership of the Labour Party to actually manage this whole process.
Well, the Panorama film, which has created the latest furore, is an absolutely execrable piece of journalism. The woman that's interviewed as supposedly the injured party used to be an employee of the Israeli embassy and was, in fact, caught by Al Jazeera talking to a Mossad agent about destabilising the Labour Party on behalf of the Israeli government. At the same time, she's being presented as some kind of hard-done-by person. This is an orchestrated campaign against the Corbyn leadership of the Labour Party because of its pro-Palestinian views. And ultimately, of course, if we do go to war with Iran to keep the Israelis happy, then there's going to be a lot of egg over lots of people's faces, because this whole orchestrated anti-Semitism campaign, witch hunt, run from the Israeli embassy, there's no doubt about that they're behind all of this, is basically an act of war. And, the Israelis, of course, are heavily involved in international terrorism, along with the Saudis and our own intelligence services. And ultimately, of course, we may have to go to war with the State of Israel, just as we did in the 1940s.
Well, since you mention Palestine, there are a couple of meetings next Saturday, 27th of July at 2 p.m. at St. Mary on the Quays Catholic Church. Mazin Kumzia, I hope I pronounced that right, he will be talking about end times, a Palestinian view. He's a geneticist and biologist at Bethlehem University and founder of the Palestine Museum of Natural History and Biodiversity, which is a conservation project, an oasis for creatures and humans set in the heart of occupied Bethlehem. And then there's another talk at 7 p.m. next Saturday at the Palestine Museum and Cultural Centre, 27 Broad Street in Bristol. That one, it's Popular Resistance in Palestine, a History of Hope and Empowerment. So that's, hopefully, remember to read those out again next week. But anyway, staying on the anti-Semitism thing, Martin, new emails today show Jeremy Corbyn aides plan to influence the party's panel. Emails obtained by Sky News relate to a discussion about the makeup of a panel due to hear cases related to anti-Semitism within the Labour Party. Jeremy Corbyn's top aide instructed party officials to compile a dossier setting out how Labour's highest disciplinary body could be challenged. Leaked emails have revealed Mr Corbyn's chief of staff, Carrie Murphy, said it was absurd. The National Constitutional Committee, which operates independently of the party's governing body, was able to overrule concerns raised by the leadership.
Well, what's happening is it's an institutional infight. Many of the people who were put in positions of authority in the Labour Party as paid officials during the Blair era were very super pro-Israel. They just were. And if you look at all these people who are banging on about anti-Semitism, if you actually look at their voting record, they all voted in favour of the war in Iraq, for example, like Margaret Hodge. So in other words, these people are not independent in their views.
I'll put a link up to this story on our show page. A Jewish group claimed the emails show the party's leadership want to interfere over anti-Semitism cases and are not prepared to let the NCC be independent.
Well, a political party doesn't have to be have independent people looking into it. Once there's a Board of Deputies of British Jews are saying they wanted to appoint an ombudsman to look into the Labour Party and decide who was and who was not anti-Semitic. Now, these people are basically Tory voters, and they're insisting that they can have somebody that decides what the Labour Party can and can't do. Ultimately, this is about politics. The State of Israel is in flagrant violation of international law. If they were called Serbia, we would already bomb them. But they're called Israel, so we basically have to kowtow to them. It can't go on. It can't go on.
So anyway, earlier this week I spoke to Anton Chaikin, and his father was involved in the American Jewish boycott of Nazi Germany back in the 1930s. And I asked him what he made of Labour and the anti-Semitism row.
You can have a laugh at some of this, because if you examine the attacks against Mr. Corbyn, Labour Party leader, on this account that his faction is anti-Semitic, these attacks emanate from institutions and billionaires associated with the City of London and the offshore system. I've looked into this quite a bit. You have the same kind of thing that goes back to the original problem in the 1930s. My father, Jacob Chaitkin, was the legal director and strategist for the boycott against Nazi Germany carried out by the American Jewish Congress and the American Federation of Labor. This boycott against Hitler was before Hitler had really a big army to start a war, but he was in power. And that boycott was opposed by the leading Jewish bank in Wall Street, the Kuhn Loeb, and their organization, the American Jewish Committee. They were intensely loyal to the British system and to the international system that at that time was promoting Hitler and Mussolini. And they held press conferences in New York to denounce the boycott against Hitler Germany. That was in 1933. My father was an FDR Democrat. And thank God we had FDR to stand up to Wall Street and to force Churchill. I mean, Churchill and the British stood up to bombing, but Churchill and his faction wanted to keep the war going on forever. They didn't want to overthrow Hitlerism. They wanted to have a war that would be perpetual. And we finally were able to invade France, and together with the Russians and with the bravery of the forces, including the British and everybody else that was on our side, and the Chinese, we won that war. But the war continued after that. I don't think World War II was ever concluded. That's the problem. We've got to bring that to an end and go and simply say that the alliance that we had in World War II to fight fascism should be resumed and enhanced. We should have the friendship between the great powers, all the great powers, to preserve civilization and take it further. Civilization is worth saving, despite radical environmentalism, despite whatever atheistic doctrines can be brought up now. Civilization is precious, and it's something we ought to acquaint our children with and work with between the great powers to solve our problems, including solving things like terrorism. We don't need wars to do that. The wars are causing the terrorism, not solving them. We need, for example, you want to solve the ISIS problem, have the great powers send their troops into the banks in Saudi Arabia and London and shut down the bank accounts, shut down the drug supply for the people on amphetamines carrying out these terrorists. Operations in Syria, and make peace with. We have no real enemies of nations. No nation is our enemy. Iran, North Korea, Russia, China, all the ones that are talked about in Washington, or that Washington is pushed to go against from London. It's insane that all the nations have the same interest, and that is to have a future with an industry, science, and high skills and high wages that come from those things.
That's Anton Chaitkin there speaking to me earlier this week. Martin, I mean, he's really implying there that World War II never ended. He's saying that actually we have now got together with a fascist faction, which were the Nazis in the Second World War, to carry on the fight against Russia.
Well, as you know, Tony, a lot of top Nazis were integrated into NATO's intelligence structure from the get-go. Reinhard Gehlen, the former head of the Gestapo in Eastern Europe, became the head of the West German intelligence services after the war.
And what about what he was saying there about the bank Kuhn Loeb and the American Jewish Committee that the bank ran and controlled and funded versus the American Jewish Congress and the Federation of American Labour that his father was involved in that constructed the boycott against Hitler in 1933?
Well, that's right. And of course, the main group that one of the groups that collaborated with Hitler were the Zionists, who were a tiny minority in the world Jewish community. But they wanted the same thing as Hitler wanted. They wanted the Jews out of Germany. They wanted them in Israel. And there was a scoping meeting where a top Zionist activist and a SS colonel went to what was then British Mandate Palestine to look at the possibility of German Jews going there. And there was a medal struck with the Star of David on one side and a swastika on the other.
What was the American Jewish Committee doing supporting Hitler and Mussolini in the 30s then?
Well, don't forget that the oligarchy all over the world supported Hitler and Mussolini because they smashed the communists and prevented the possibility of any kind of socialist development out of the economic crisis of the 1930s. And, just as, some Jews are wealthy billionaires, and they sided with the other wealthy billionaires to support to keep Hitler and Mussolini going as a means of smashing their political opponents on the left.
Representing the entire city, this is BCFM. BCFM 93.2.
We finished this evening by having a listen to Catherine Austin Fitz. She is comparing here African and modern slavery and is really concerned about the move towards keeping all our money in little microchips.
If you look at where the currency system is going, you have an effort to develop digital currencies that will be far more conducive of surveillance, invasion, and I think of even chipping people. Tim Wu wrote a fantastic book that I'm always recommending. It's one of the best books for 2018 in the annual wrap-up, and it's called The Master Switch, and he describes the history of information technology, where there's a period of blossoming and innovation, and then, bam, it's used to centralize. And on each process of centralization, the central control grows. Mm-hmm. And my concern about that what's next in terms of digital next in terms of currencies is I think where the leadership wants to go is they basically want to be able to collateralize a human being. So if I can integrate digital technology into you, then I can track you and I can use you as collateral. And you're back. Collateral. Okay, so let me give you an example. Mm-hmm. One of the books that most profoundly affected me over the last 2 years was a book called The Half Has Never Been Told. It's a history of the economics of the American slave trade. Mm-hmm. And there were two things in it that really stunned me. One was the slave population grew up built up on the East Coast, and they decided as it built up to create three large corporations, Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, to really build a cotton juggernaut, and they had a mass migration of slaves into those plantations. And one of the things they stipulated was that 70% should be single males between the ages of 17 and 35. And when I was reading the book, I was also doing an interview of someone about the European immigration situation, and I went to the EU website, and they noted that on all the immigrants that had come into Europe and also Germany that year, 70% were single males between 17 and 35.
Oh.
And I said, apparently it's the same playbook. Mm-hmm. You know, it hasn't changed. Mm-hmm. That was number one. The second thing was there were two reasons why they canceled the slave trade. And one of them was that the banks in London kept losing money because every time commodity prices would drop, they would sell, the plantation owners would sell the slaves west, and there was no way for the banks to prove that that slave belonged to them.
Mm-hmm.
So there was no way to perfect a lien. There was no way to collateralize. If you can integrate digital technology into humans physically, suddenly you can. And that is a huge change. I think there is a tremendous effort underway to encourage people to accept wearing chips, mm-hmm. integrating chips into their body. And the reality is, as soon as you can do that,
yeah.
you can use a human being to collateralize a loan. And then you're talking about taking away one of the primary reasons why they canceled the slave trade.
Well, fascinating little tidbit there from Catherine Austin Fitz, Martin.
Yeah, I've just been reading a book about the cotton industry and the, you know, the history of it in the 19th century, and of course the plantations were worthless without the slaves. So the slaves were definitely, you know, the banks would lend to plantation owners.
So are the banks taking us back via a vicarious route to the slave days?
Well.
I mean, they talk about wage slavery, don't they?
Yeah, well, I mean, the powerful have always tried to use any methods they can to keep the poor at their mercy.
Okay, time to sign off for the US-owned Comcast News at 8. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Lib Dem prospective parliamentary candidate for Bristol West, James Cox. You'll find this show's podcast story links comment page and our contact details at this week. One word. org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Our sister show Dialects here next Tuesday at noon. We go to Glastonbury. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Live from the Sky News Centre.